Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
All right, next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we got Julianne Andrews, the principal with Atlanta Financial Associates. Welcome, Julianne.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Julianne, the first thing that everybody wants to know is, what's it like to have the name of someone famous? Is that a blessing or a curse?
It is actually a good thing. You will never forget my name.
You will never.
Julie Andrews. It's been, you know, on my business card, you'll see Julianne, so we can dispense with those jokes early on.
Right.
But no one will ever forget my name.
So you have to deal with this every time?
Every time. I always tell people only for the last 35 years since I got married. That's what was the thing. Exactly.
So did you consider that when you were getting married? Were you weighing that in your head?
I did weigh that in my head. Great guy, though. So I moved forward.
So you went forward. So tell us about Atlanta Financial Associates. How are you serving folks?
So this is a really exciting time for our firm, and I'm glad to be here today to talk about it. You know, there's a lot of choices in Atlanta and all over the country, really, for investment advisory firms. We just this summer celebrated our 26th anniversary as a firm, and we're very proud of that. Also proud that despite all the noise and all the other options out there, we've been recognized nationally on the Forbes honor list of best financial advisors. And actually in January, our firm will be in the Wall Street Journal as one of the wealth management firms you should know. So it's an exciting time for us, and I'm happy to be able to talk about it.
So now, is there a difference between like an investment firm, a wealth management firm? Are these all synonyms, or are there different services associated with them?
There's a lot of confusion out there. So we would call ourselves a wealth management firm. And what that is really, and by our definition, is a very comprehensive relationship with clients. So we can do a financial plan for a client to help them meet all their financial objectives. But not just that, really talk to them about what their desires, goals, and dreams are. What do you really want to do? What's all this money for? What's the purpose of this, and how do you want to manage that? We do obviously manage investment portfolios for clients. So our tagline is making life's journey richer. And the idea behind that is clearly it has a double meaning. We are growing portfolios for clients, but we also want to make sure that your life is rich, you accomplish all your goals, and we understand all of that.
Now, is that a disconnect in the mind of some maybe people new to this, that they think like your job is really to just make more money for me, and they're not looking at their life holistically as what do I want to accomplish? What kind of legacy do I want to lead? Things like that.
That is a challenge. There are firms out there that simply manage portfolios for clients. That's not us. So when a client comes to us, a new client, we spend a lot of time talking to them about their goals, their objectives, their dreams, the kind of legacy they want to leave for their family. We work with a lot of multi-generational families. I have many instances where I'm working with three generations. And so we spend a lot of time making sure there's a good fit between what we do and what we really bring to the table and what the client's looking for. If they're looking for just simply portfolio returns, we're not going to be the place to go for that because we're trying to do something much bigger than that. You're going to get portfolio returns, but we're going to help you do a lot of other things too.
Now, I read recently, and it seems like you're addressing this by dealing with the different members of the family, that the vast majority of when a person dies, their kid doesn't go with that same financial advisor. It was like 60 years. I was shocked at the number. And that to me was such a missed opportunity for the industry because it was like, you've been dealing with this family for decades and you're not engaging the children. I mean, that seems like a missed opportunity.
It's a huge, huge miss. And I think a lot of firms fall into that trap.
So that's a true statistic?
That is a true statistic that about, I think it's about 60% of second generation folks do not stay with the same firm. Part of that is because they don't really understand what the value that's brought to the table. Part of it is if you are simply managing a portfolio for a client, they see you as managing a portfolio. Well, I've got my guy. Maybe I live in Cleveland. I'm not right in Atlanta. So what do I care? I've got somebody here that can do that. But if you include the members of the family and all the different generations and they understand what you're doing for them, they look upon you very differently. We also take a team approach. So if someone's working with our firm, they're not just going to work with Julie Andrews. They're going to work with me and my team. There are a number of people that they can contact. And so what happens is, and some of the folks on my team are younger than I am, and so they will develop a particular rapport with someone, but they feel that they have a real relationship and a real kind of a bond to the firm that you wouldn't have if we weren't reaching out that way. So in our case, it's unusual, actually, when a client passes away that their second or third generation don't stay with our firm.
So now walk me through like a new client. How does that even occur? Because I would imagine most of your clients already have a financial advisor or somebody that's advising them in some manner. They're not kind of doing it themselves, right?
Yeah. Well, the vast majority of our clients actually are referrals from existing clients. And that's nothing could make me happier than that, because that's a real testament to how they feel about what we do for them. We do also get referrals from CPAs and attorneys that we work with. But when a client comes to us, generally speaking, you're correct. They do already have a financial advisor. Most folks will have a financial advisor, or they'll have somebody that they feel like is a financial advisor.
Right.
But there's some reason. And the first question we always ask them is, why did you call our firm? You know, and to really ascertain, because there's usually some underlying concern or question, something that they feel like is not being addressed in their current situation. And usually it's not feeling like they're getting that holistic approach, not feeling like somebody's pulling everything together for them and helping them make sure that there aren't any traps out there that they haven't identified.
Now, is the financial advisor kind of the quarterback of a family's kind of financial side of their life? You know, are they helping with the insurance and the taxes? Are they kind of having their fingers in all those pies, or are they just a part of the team?
I will call myself a quarterback very frequently. I'll say, we're going to be your financial quarterback. And what that means is I'm going to make sure that all the pieces of the pie fit together. So we're going to look at your entire situation. If it looks like you need your will redone, for instance, we'll work with your existing attorney to make sure that that happens appropriately, or we can refer you to somebody else if you'd like to do that. We'll look at your insurance portfolio. We will work with the insurance person that you're working with and make sure that whatever we feel is missing is put in place. But we want to be kind of the go-to quarterback. So I have clients that call me about all kinds of things. I have clients that call me about little things like, should I buy or lease a car? And then clients that call me about big things. Gosh, I'm thinking about selling my house and, going to Europe for a couple of years. I actually have a client that's doing that right now. How would that look? That's different than what we've talked about before. But I want people to call me about all those things, big and small.
And then, so is there a typical rhythm of how often you speak, or that varies client to client?
Usually varies client to client. When we typically take on a new client, there'll be a lot of meetings in that first year because there's a lot happening. We're getting to know you. We're making sure that everything is set up the way you want it to be set up. We're getting to know your other advisors, if you will. So all that's happening. After that, typically we'll meet with clients a couple of times a year, but we're interacting with them much more frequently than that because, again, they're calling us and asking us questions. But we'll typically do a couple of formal meetings a year just to review their situation and really, yes, we spend some time talking about their portfolio and the financial markets. That's obviously, they expect me to do that. But we spend more time talking about, are they still on plan? Are they still where we thought they should be to meet the goals we discussed and they want to accomplish?
And then so that on plan, that could be quarterly, 6 months?
Could be quarterly. Some clients we meet with as frequently as quarterly. Some clients like to do that. A lot of times we'll meet with clients more frequently initially for the first several years. And then they, okay, I get it. On track.
Right.
I feel comfortable. And they'll go down to maybe a couple of times a year.
Now, are you seeing a trend to go with kind of the boutique services like yours as opposed to kind of the TV commercial ones?
There is a trend in that direction. You're seeing a big move in the industry to go independent. So you're seeing a lot of firms in the industry move from the big wirehouses like a UBS or a Wells Fargo or the banks, those kinds of things. You'll see them move away from that and become completely independent. When they do that, a lot of times that allows them to really craft their business the way they think it needs to be to serve the client base that they have. So they're not being driven by products or services that UBS or Morgan Stanley wants.
So when you say they, who's the they?
So the investment advisory firm. So if an investment advisor decides, I'm going to go independent, I want to leave the confines of being with a wirehouse or a bank, and I want to be completely independent, that allows them to structure their business in a completely agnostic fashion with respect to technology, pricing, all of that. And that's actually something that our firm did this summer that's very exciting. So we left an independent broker-dealer, became an independent registered investment advisor, which allows us to really tailor all the products and services to what we feel our clients need to meet their goals.
So what's the pros and cons of making a move like that? So what you're giving something up by doing that, right?
Well, when you're working, when you're with a larger firm, they're providing everything to you. So they're providing a suite of technology to you. You have the pricing is set. Typically with an independent firm, an independent broker dealer, you can offer whatever products you want, but the offerings might be limited by selling agreements that the broker dealer has. In the independent registered investment advisory space, there is none of that.
Right. You have a blank sheet of paper,
You have
right?
a blank sheet of paper. I can use whatever technology solutions I want. We can select the firm that where we want to hold our assets. It might be Schwab. In our case, it is Schwab, but it could be Schwab. It could be Fidelity. It could be TD. It could be a combination of those. You are really operating your own business. You're making all those decisions from pricing to technology to deliver the best service possible to your clients.
And that way you can customize the solution no matter, you're not tied to one thing anymore.
No, you're not tied to one thing, and you can look at each client situation individually and determine what will actually meet this client's needs and then craft a solution for that particular client.
So now, and you said this is a trend in the industry, more and more are doing that?
More and more are doing that. And it's really simply because there is, you know, Wells Fargo is a perfect example. You know, I might be a great advisor, but if I'm at Wells Fargo, I've got a problem now. And right. so that then, and I didn't have any control over that. So advisors.
But you're taking the hit for their.
You're taking the hit for behavior, their behavior, for the decisions that they made at the corporate level. So if you're completely independent, you don't have any of that. I mean, you have only yourself to answer to and your clients, because that's really the bottom line.
Now, in this world, I hear the word fiduciary thrown around. Can you explain what that is and why that's important?
Yeah, there is some confusion there. So that really the literal definition of fiduciary is acting in the client's best interest. And I think the general public would expect an investment advisor to always act in their best interest, right. along with their physician and their attorney and their right. CPA and any other professional they see. There has been, though, some resistance in the industry to hold yourself out as a fiduciary, because the feeling was, well, gosh, if I do that, then I have additional liability. Our firm has always been on the other side of that. We've always held ourselves out as fiduciaries. We make that very clear. If you look at our website, that's very clear. I actually have, and all the advisors at our firm have designations that speak to fiduciary. So I'm an AIF, which is accredited investment fiduciary. And it's important for us to hold ourselves out that way, because we want to make sure that we're very clear that everything we're doing, everything we're recommending is going to be in your best interest.
But it fiduciary doesn't mean that the stock market's going up and all your money's going to get, you're going to make more of it. It's just, you're going to be a responsible steward.
I'm going to be a responsible steward of your money. And when I make a recommendation to you, whether it be a recommendation in terms of needing to get your legal documents drafted or a different investment strategy, I'm doing that because I feel it's in your best interest. You know, we can never, there's no guarantees in my industry.
Right.
We can't guarantee right. anything. But what we're trying to do is to help you meet your financial goals, understanding that there's going to be ups and downs in the markets right. in between.
And that's part of the relationship, is to understand the client's risk tolerance and to put them in things that they're comfortable with.
We spend a lot of time on that. For better or worse, I went all the way through 2008, 2009. I went through the tech bubble at the end of the, and I've been doing this for 30 years. So,
right, so
I've been through a lot of these.
You've seen some ups and downs.
A lot of these. And the key with meeting financial goals, because I know I've had conversations with clients 20 or 25 years ago about what they wanted to accomplish. And now here we are 25 years later, and they're doing exactly what we planned. So that's the really cool part about what I do. But I know for a fact that to get you there, I have to find a portfolio that has a level of risk in it that will allow you to ride out those ups and downs, because I know that they're coming. I don't know when they're coming.
Right.
I know they are coming.
They don't ring a bell.
No. If I knew when they were coming, that would be fantastic for everybody. I just know that it will happen. And so when something like a 2008 happened, we literally called all of our clients, and then we called all of them again, and then we called all of them again. And
right.
the objective was not to tell them when the market was going to turn back up or to make some kind of an investment recommendation. The objective was just to make sure that they were comfortable, that they felt comfortable writing this out, that we were on top of it, and that making a change in the midst of something like that is the worst thing you can do.
Right.
So we're very proud of the fact that very, very few of our clients actually jumped out of their portfolios over that period of time. I work with about 170 families, and I think I had three or four that just said, I hear what you're saying. I can't take it.
The sky is falling.
But it was mostly just around, getting you calmed down and refocused back on why are we doing this? Why, right. You know, what are your objectives? What are your goals? And it's not what's happening today. It's what you want to happen 5 or 10 years from now.
Now, having done this for a while, what have you learned from a human behavior standpoint when it comes to risk? Like, are certain groups take more risk, or do you have any generalizations that you can you tell if a person like they want a lot of risk, or this person they don't want any risk?
There's a litany of things that we do, some questions we ask, that we take people through to try to help them,
yes,
and try to help them figure out exactly where are you on the risk spectrum.
Right.
We look at their existing portfolio to see where that slots with respect to.
So it's one thing to say it, another to demonstrate
it
when you're actually writing a check.
You're telling me you're really aggressive, but your portfolio is all in CD. So how does that mean? So you're not, that doesn't match up. So we'll spend a lot of time doing that. And the idea behind all that is just to make sure that we've talked about it. We actually have clients sign an investment policy statement, which just says, this is the risk level I think I'm comfortable with. Obviously, it's not cast in concrete. It's your money. We can change it. But it is something we can go back to and say, okay, what's changed since we signed this? Let's talk about that.
Right. So it's like if someone says, I don't want to take any risk, but can you put me in some Bitcoin, you know, that's not congruent, right?
That's not congruent. And that's where, you know, having those good conversations up front is productive, because if clients come into our office and they're just kind of kicking the tires and they say things like that, then, you know, we'll tell them, look, this is not going to be a great fit for you. This is not what this firm does. We're here to help you accomplish your goals and dreams. We're not here to
My kid showed me this blog.
Yeah. Or I have a client whose son was saying, Mom, you need to invest in some marijuana stocks. I'm like, okay, that's great for your 30-year-old son. Not so great for Mom. Yeah.
Right.
So we have, you know, we always go back to what are we trying to accomplish here.
Now, what about from a technology standpoint? Does your firm lean on technology? So for your clients to access their accounts and can they make changes with the technology?
We do. So we have a very robust client portal that clients can go into. They can look at their portfolios there. They can actually aggregate other accounts there. They can make their 401k feed through there if they want to, their bank account, so they can actually see everything in one place. They can look at their financial plan out there.
It's a dashboard where they can kind of get an idea of how they're doing.
They can see how they're doing. They can see if they're still on plan. With respect to trading their own accounts, that's a really good question, because actually prior to this summer, with us making this move, they could not do that. Now we can. We have our accounts at Schwab. So if someone, and I have a few clients who like to have a brokerage account and play around with some stocks rather than calling us and having us place the trades, I can turn on Trading Authority and you can do it yourself if you'd like to, or we can do it for you. It's just up to you.
Now, part of your firm's uniqueness is that you serve, I don't know if it's primarily, but you have a heavy dose of physicians. Is that?
I do in my own.
That's your own personal?
In my own personal.
But the firm isn't.
There are three partners in the firm and four wealth managers, and each one of us has a little bit of a special kind of niche, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
My own niche happens to be physicians, and I work with quite a few physicians. Most of them are in private practice. Really happened organically. That guy whose last name is Andrews happens to be a physician. So
right.
When I started doing
just
this,
a coincidence.
Just a coincidence. So when I started doing this 30 years ago, I knew physicians. Mm-hmm. I started talking to them, and physicians will tend to refer you to other physicians.
Right.
And so that just kind of grew organically. It's a group that has sort of a special kind of collection of challenges, if you will. When I first started doing this, the challenge was really around a shortened work cycle because of their extended training. So a reduced amount of time that they had to earn money and build a portfolio.
To pay back all the debt they have.
And they usually start with
right.
a lot of debt.
Right.
You know, honestly, with new physicians, we don't even bother doing a balance sheet because their net worth is going to be negative.
Right. You already know going in.
There's no point showing it. It's just depressing. So that's always been there, and that continues to be the case. But now there are additional issues that physicians face. Like I said, most of the physicians I work with are in private practice, so they're actually small business owners. They've got very compressed revenue streams because there's a lot of pressure on reimbursements at this
right.
point from Medicare, Medicaid, but also health insurance companies. A lot of increased regulations that they're dealing with, which are increasing their costs. Everything from, you know, the super bill that you get when you leave your physician's office, that's actually mandated by the government, what's on there, and how they code that will dictate how they're reimbursed. So they all have a lot of increased costs and reduced revenue streams. So they're under a lot of financial pressure as well. And that's why you see a lot of private practices merging it with hospitals now. It's just a way for them to kind of get out from underneath all that regulatory and profit margin compression burden.
Now, when you do focus in on one kind of niche, like you mentioned, you kind of start learning best practices, the do's and don'ts of that. So is there any kind of, I don't want to say business consulting, but there is some like, hey, you know, you might want to consider using this type of thing. And I got a guy over here that's really, when he made this change, this helped this, or she was able to kind of save a lot of time because she moved to this technology.
We do have the advantage that we work with a number of different practices so we can see what worked and what doesn't work. I've had practices that have sold out to publicly traded companies. How did that work? I've had practices that have merged in with hospitals. How did that work?
Right.
I've had practices that have unraveled all those things. How did that work? And we also have a group of other advisors, medical consultants who actually will work with the medical practice on various issues, even down to hiring, that kind of thing. Should they open another office? We work with CPAs and attorneys who work with a lot of medical practices. There's kind of a group of us that are sort of like a team that we know work with a lot of physicians and have experience in that area.
So that's one of the benefits of working. If you're a physician and you're choosing a financial advisor, this is one of the advantages of working with you, is because you're coming to the table not just with that. That's kind of table stakes, right? It's all this ancillary information and insight.
Exactly. All the other insight that I've developed over the last 30 years of watching the industry develop and watching the challenges there. And, you know, it helps that it impacts my own personal bottom line, too. I mean, my husband's a physician.
Right.
I understand exactly the student loans, and I get the price compression. I understand all of that.
Now, what about the exit? Like, how do physicians typically exit?
You know, that really varies by practice. Typically, most practices are going to have a buy-sell agreement like any other professional firm would. They will typically have some sort of a buyout that usually happens over a number of years. It tends to not be a real significant item. Many of them, it looks more like their receivables that they're leaving behind. A few of them will price in some other things, but there's really not thought to be a lot of goodwill in medical practices typically. So most of my physicians will end up leaving, but the buyout is going to be a fairly small part of their financial plan in retirement.
So, but is that part of what you're helping them understand and to plan for?
We do help them understand. So, for instance, when we do retirement projections, we'll put that in there. We have to understand how that's going to be taxed. We have to understand how likely that is to happen, what that amount might be. So it's something that we do factor in. But I have a number of physicians who say, you know what, don't put in anything for that because I'm not sure that's going to happen. And
right.
And we can do that too.
So now, when you say physicians, that's medical physicians, not like dentists.
We do work with some dentists, but I tend to have a preponderance of medical of MDs.
But dentists would have a different strategy and different. Is there similarities? Or
it's actually fairly similar. They, you know, a lot of them in private practice. They have a lot of the same kinds of issues. The insurance reimbursements are a little bit different. The buyouts tend to be a little bit different, but it's fairly similar.
What about like plastic surgeons, like things that are not typically covered by insurance? Is that different?
That is different. That is different because if you're a plastic surgeon and you can take credit cards, for instance, and you're not accepting reimbursements. Actually, my husband has said before, gosh, I should have gone into plastic surgery because all of this, you know, they still have the regulatory environment, but they don't have the pricing is a little bit different.
So, but you work with those as well?
I do have some physicians in that area. Yeah. But I will say as a general rule, regardless of the specialty that the physician is in, I really can't think of a single physician that I work with that has not had declining income over the last 5 to 8 years.
Really?
As a group, declining in actual dollars. So that's just kind of the nature of the – because of their increased expenses and because of the regulations, that's just kind of the nature of where the
is. Has that impacted new people choosing to get into medicine?
I think it has. You know, when you look at the length of time it takes to get into medicine, you're going to be at least 30 before you start practicing. Many of the new physicians are more in their mid-30s, depending on what kind of a specialty. If it's a surgical specialty, it's pretty lengthy. And then they're going to have a lot of debt. $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 is not uncommon. So to get past all of that and not even start working until you're 35, you need to really be in a position where this is what I love to do. This is what I want to do. This is how I want to help people. I think I'm going to make a lot of money being a physician, because the future is very uncertain.
And the window of time is short.
The window of time is short. So if I start when I'm 35 and I want to retire when I'm 60, I mean, that's a much shorter window than somebody who graduates from college when they're 22.
So that's interesting. The unintended consequences.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So now for you, how do you see the next, now you made this change, so how do you see the next few years in your firm?
So we're really excited about this change because it opens up a lot of opportunities to us. It really allows us to, as I mentioned earlier, to offer some things to clients, not just the trading platform, but really customize what we're offering to our clients that we haven't been able to do before. It also allows us a lot of opportunities for growth. So previously we've been growing organically. There are three partners in the firm, as I mentioned, and we bring on new clients. But this also allows us the opportunity to, for instance, find other like-minded advisors and merge our practices together. And it affords us that opportunity. It's much easier to do that in the independent space. And so when you merge additional advisors together, you'll have additional areas of expertise that just allow us to serve an even broader group of clients.
But you still want to focus in on, like, is that a good strategy for an up-and-coming financial advisor, is to kind of have a niche that you serve and then just kind of being the go-to person in that specialty?
You know, it's interesting because when I started doing this, candidly, I kind of resisted that because I thought, well, I don't want to say I do this because then I won't work with other clients. As it turns out, I think developing an area of expertise really allows you to grow your practice much more quickly, also allows you to offer a much higher level of value to the clients that you're working with. Now, I work with a lot of different clients.
It's not exclusively physicians, but by having a specialty, you do have a depth of knowledge there that most people don't have.
That most people don't have. That's exactly right. And so one of my partners, for instance, has a specialty with divorced women. There are a lot of things from a tax standpoint and things like that. She actually has a special certification there. That brings a lot of expertise to the table. Another one of my partners is a CPA. Now, he doesn't do tax returns at this point, but he has obviously a keen understanding of accounting. So he works with a lot of business owners,
right.
So it really helps us as a firm target the clients and help them move to whatever advisor is going to best suit their needs and really deliver what that client needs.
Now, can you share a story of maybe you work with somebody that started out that didn't have a lot of resources, and now over their course of their career, you help them build this richer life's journey?
I can, actually.
Obviously don't name their name. Unless it's Arnold. Is it Arnold?
I only play a doctor on TV.
We won't name names. But I have a couple of really interesting stories. One is a couple that I've worked with for probably 10 or 12 years, and their dream was to retire and buy an RV and sell their house and travel all over the country. And, you know, I've heard a lot of stories over the years about the ideas that people want to do, and a lot of times those things change. But these folks were very, very single-minded, very purposeful. We did a lot of talking about you probably want to take a few trips in that RV and make sure
to practice.
See if do you really want to be in this environment with your spouse for an extended period of time?
But on TV, it looked a lot of fun.
It looked like a lot of fun, exactly. But they retired about 2 years ago. The initial plan was to do this for a year. They are still traveling around in their RV. I think that their objective now is to visit every national park. When they come through town, they'll stop and we'll meet. So that's a really fun story that, you know, it's something that we worked on for that 10-year period of time. I have another client who is interested in taking a sabbatical. She it works for herself, so she wants to take a sabbatical. Her husband's already retired, and they want to live in Europe for a couple of years. And so the idea there is, how can we make sure that that happens? How can we make sure that even if you decide you want to stay in Europe, or when you come back, you don't want to go back to work, that that's still okay, and you can go over there and enjoy yourselves and not worry about what's going to happen 2 years later. So that's something that we are working on, and I think it probably will happen in the next year or two.
Now, is there a magic number that people should shoot for when it comes to retiring?
That is a good question, and it's one we get asked a lot, actually. And really, the number depends, and it depends on when you want to retire and what you want to do when you retire. So if you want to spend $5,000 a month when you retire and you don't want to retire until you're 70, it's one thing. If you want to spend $40,000 a month when you retire and you want to retire when you're 55, there's a different number. You know, Fidelity talks about their numbers, and that what we're trying to do is help each person identify where they need to be. And, you know, there's really, if it looks like it's going to be difficult to do, there's a bunch of different levers we can pull. You can work a couple of years longer. You can spend a little bit less. You can save a little bit more. We work with clients until we come up with a plan that they're comfortable with. And then that's what we move towards. So that's why it's important for them to be able to go to our portal and say, hey, am I still on track? Am I still where I need to be so that I can retire when I'm 58 and buy that boat or whatever it is I said I wanted to do.
Now, are you finding that more people have kind of resigned themselves to, I got to work longer, at least part-time. I can't just turn this money faucet off at this age.
With our clients, usually what happens is it's not because they have to, it's because they want to. So for most of our clients, they've been very successful in their careers. They love what they do. That's why they're in the financial situation that they are. So we might plan to have them retire at 60, but here we are 62, 65, they're still working. Because they want to.
Because every day you got to do something. Isn't that a myth that, like, oh, I'm going to stop working, I'm going to be at the beach? I mean, that gets boring after a while, right?
Exactly. And so what we spend a lot of time doing is talking to you about, okay, if you want to retire when you're 60, you're still relatively young. So what do you want to do?
Right, join a nonprofit or do something for your legacy, right?
And to my earlier point, and try that out maybe before you jump off the bridge. Try that nonprofit and see if you enjoy it. Try traveling like you said you want to do and see if you enjoy it. Try those things. You know, before you commit and buy a house in Maine because you thought that'd always be cool, rent one for a month or two right. And see what you think. because I've seen people do stuff like that.
Right,
and
that
it doesn't
they go all
work.
In, spend all their money, and then they're like, I hate it.
And
here.
Then they're
it's
calling
boring,
me six
right?
months later saying, I don't know what I'm doing up here. Okay, yeah, yeah. That's happened. Yeah.
Well, if somebody wanted to learn more and have more substantive conversation, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Well, best way to get a hold of us is to go out to our website, which is atlantafinancial.com.
Good URL there. That probably paid off for you.
It is
$12 a year well spent.
It is. We thought of that early on, and it was a good spend. So go to our website. There's a lot of information about our firm, a lot of information about the advisors at our firm, and you can just click on a button, and we'll give you a buzz back and see what your questions are.
Well, Julianne, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.